stopped short of their destination. The coffee shop was closed, what with the blackout conditions imposed on a city half at war and half at peace. Streetlights were off and windows draped, but cars were allowed to drive about with lights, and domestic electricity was evidently on. That worked to their benefit. The door lock was easily defeated in the unlit alley. Chavez eased the door open and looked inside. Clark followed, lugging the case, and both men went inside, closing the door behind them. They were already on the second floor when they heard noises. A family lived here. It turned out to be a husband and wife in their 50s, proprietors of the eating place, watching television. Had the mission been properly planned, he knew, they would have established that sooner. Oh, well.
Hello, Clark said quietly. Please do not make any noise.
What?
We will not hurt you, John said as Ding looked around for. Yes, electric cords would do just fine. Please lie down on the floor.
Who?
We will let you go when we leave, Clark went on in literate Farsi. But if you resist, we must hurt you.
They were too terrified to resist the two men who had appeared like thieves in their home. Clark used the light cords to tie their arms, then their ankles. Chavez laid them on their sides, first getting the woman some water before he gagged her.
Make sure they can breathe, Clark said, in English this time.
He checked all the knots, pleased that he remembered his basic seamanship skills from 30 years before. Satisfied, they went upstairs. The truly crazy part was the communications lash-up. Chavez opened the case and started taking things out. The roof of the building was flat, and had a clear line of sight to another such building 3 blocks away. For that reason, they had to keep low. First of all, Ding set up the mini-dish. The tripod for it was heavy, with spiked feet to secure it to the roof. Next he had to turn it, to get the buzzing chirp of the carrier signal from the proper satellite. That done, he twisted the clamp to lock the dish in place. Then came the camera. This, too, had a tripod. Chavez set that up, screwed the camera in place, and aimed it, switching it on and pointing it at the center of the 3 buildings that held their interest. Then the cable from the camera went into the transmitter power supply box, which they left in the opened suitcase.
It's running, John.
The odd part was that they had an uplink, but not a downlink. They could download signals from the satellite, but there wasn't a separate audio channel for them to use. For that, they needed additional equipment, which they didn't have.
There it is, Robbie Jackson reported from the National Military Command Center.
That's the one, Mary Pat Foley confirmed, looking at the same picture.
She dialed a phone number to the American Embassy in Moscow, from there to the Russian Foreign Ministry, from there to the Russian Embassy in Tehran, and from there by the digital phone in John's hand.
"Do you hear me, Ivan?" she asked in Russian. "It's Folieva."
It took a very long second for the reply to come through.
"Ah, Maria, how good to hear your voice."
"Thank God for the phone company," John thought to himself, letting out a long breath. "Even the one here."
"I have your picture here on my desk," she said next.
"I was so much younger then."
"He's in place and everything's cool," the DDO said.
Okay. Jackson lifted another phone. It's a go. I repeat, it's a go. Acknowledge.
Operation Booth is go, Diggs confirmed from Riyadh. The Iranian air defense system was about as tense as it could be. Though no attack at all had been launched into their territory, the radar operators were keeping a close eye on things. They watched several aircraft patrolling the Saudi and Qatari coasts, mainly running parallel, not even pushing toward the center of the waterway. Bandit 251 and Bandit 252 completed refueling from their tankers within seconds of each other. It wasn't often that stealth fighters operated in unison. They were, in fact, designed to operate entirely alone. But not this time. Both separated from the KC-10s and turned north for a flight of about 1 hour, albeit with 1,000 feet of vertical separation. The tanker crews remained on station and used the time to refuel the standing fighter patrol on the Saudi coast, exactly routine for night operations. 50 miles away, an AWACS tracked everything.
or almost. The E-3B couldn't detect an F-117 either.
"We keep meeting like this," the president said to the makeup woman, with forced good humor. "You look very tired," Mary Abbott told him.
"I am pretty tired," Ryan admitted.
"Your hands are shaking."
"Lack of sleep." This was a lie.
Callie Weston was typing alterations to the speech directly into the electronic memory of the teleprompter. Even the TV technicians were not allowed to see the content of this one, and in a way she was surprised that she herself was. She finished, scanning the whole thing for typos, which she'd learned over the years could be very disconcerting to presidents on live TV. Some of them were smoking, Clark saw, the guards outside. Poor discipline, but maybe it did serve to keep people awake.
"John, you ever think that this job is maybe just a little too exciting?"
"Gotta take a leak?"
It was the usual reaction, even for them.
"Yeah. Me too." It was something that never made the James Bond movies.
I didn't know that.
Clark pressed the earpiece in, hearing a normal voice, as opposed to one of a known announcer, say that the president would be on in 2 minutes. Maybe some network director, he thought. With that, the last two items came out of the suitcase.
"My fellow Americans, I am here to give you an updated report on the situation in the Middle East," the president said without preamble. "Approximately 4 hours ago, organized resistance ceased among the forces of the United Islamic Republic, which invaded the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Saudi, Kuwaiti, and American forces, working together, have destroyed 6 divisions in a battle which raged through a night and a day. I can now tell you that our country dispatched the 10th and 11th Cavalry Regiments, plus the 1st Brigade of the North Carolina National Guard, and the 366th Wing from Mountain Home Air Force Base in Idaho. A massive battle was fought south of King Khalid Military City. You have already seen some of the details on TV. The final UIR units attempted to flee the battlefield to the north, but they were cut off, and after a brief engagement they began to surrender. Ground combat in the area has, for the moment, concluded. I say, for the moment, because this war is unlike any most of us have known in the past 50 years. An attack was made directly upon our citizens, on our soil. It was an attack deliberately made upon civilians. It was an attack made using a weapon of mass destruction. The violations of international law are too numerous to list, the president went on. But it would be wrong to say that this attack was made by the people of the United Islamic Republic upon America. Peoples do not make war. The decision to start a war is most often made by one man. They used to be kings, or princes, or barbarian chiefs. But throughout history, it's usually one man who decides, and never is the decision to start a war of aggression the result of a democratic process. We Americans have no quarrel with the people of the former Iran and Iraq. Their religion may be different from ours, but we are a country which protects freedom of religion. Their languages may be different, but America has welcomed people of many languages. If America has proven anything to the world, it is that all men are the same, and given the same freedom and the same opportunity, they will all prosper to the limit only of their own abilities. In the last 24 hours, we killed at least 10,000 soldiers of the UIR, probably many more. We do not know now and probably never will know the total number of enemy deaths, and we need to remind ourselves that they did not choose their fates. Those fates were chosen for them by others, and ultimately by one person. Ryan clasped his hands together theatrically. It seemed a very awkward gesture to all who watched.
There it goes, Chavez said, his face to the camera's small eyepiece screen, which was now showing the download from the orbiting satellite. Start the music. Clark thumbed the laser transmitter, careful to see that it was on the invisible infrared setting.
A check through his eyepiece put the dot on the building's cornice. Or parapet, he couldn't remember the difference. Whatever, there was a guard standing there, his foot on the structure.
Diggs in Riyadh. Final check.
Bandit 251, he heard in reply.
252.
Throughout history, kings and princes have made war at their whim, sending people off to die. To the kings, they were just peasants, and the wars were just grabs for power and riches, a kind of entertainment. And if people died, nobody much cared. And when it was all over, for the most part, the kings were still kings, whether they won or lost, because they were above it all. All the way into this century, it was assumed that a chief of state had a right to make war. At Nuremberg, after the Second World War, we changed that rule by trying and executing some of those responsible. But getting to that point, arresting the criminals, as it were, cost the lives of 20 million Russians, 6 million Jews, so many lives lost that historians don't even know. Ryan looked up to see Andrea Price wave to him. She didn't smile. It was not a smiling matter. But she gave the signal anyway. The ground-based laser was only insurance. They could have gone in without it, but picking out exactly the right house in the city would have been difficult, and they wanted to limit collateral damage. This way, also, the aircraft could drop their weapons from higher altitude. Simple ballistics would guarantee a drop to within 100 yards. And the improved optic systems on the guidance packages cut that figure to 1. Exactly on time, both Bandit aircraft, Bandit was the semi-official call sign for the pilots of the Black Jets, opened their bomb bay doors. Each aircraft carried a single 500-pound weapon, the smallest that could take a paveway guidance package. These hung from a trapeze while the seeker heads looked for a modulated laser signal. Both acquired the laser dot, and so informed the pilots, who executed the release. Then they both did something neither had ever done before on a stealth mission. Bandit 251, bomb away. 252, bomb gone. Every idea in the history of man, good or bad, has started in a single human mind, and wars begin because one mind thinks it profitable to kill and steal. This time, it's happened to us in a particularly cruel way. This time, we can be exactly sure who did it. And more. Worldwide, in every country with a satellite dish and TV cable, in over 1 billion homes, the picture changed from the Oval Office of the White House to a 3-story building on a city street. Most viewers thought it some mad error, something from a movie, a bad connection. A handful knew different. Even before the president went on. Darii, too, was watching the president's speech, as much from pure curiosity as political advantage. What sort of man was this Ryan, really? He'd wondered so long. Too late, he found out. This is where he lives, Mahmoud Haji Darii, the man who attacked our country with disease, the man who attacked my child, the man who tried to attack me, the man who sent his army on a mission of conquest that turned into a mission of death. He is a man who has defiled his religion and the laws of men and nations. And now, Mr. Darii, here is the reply of the United States of America. The president's voice stopped, and a second or two later, so did translations all over the world, replaced only by silence, as eyes watched an ordinary black-and-white picture of a quite ordinary building. And yet everyone knew that something extraordinary was about to happen. Those looking very closely saw a light go on in a window, and the front door open. But no one would ever know the identity of the person who might have been attempting to leave, because both weapons fell true, struck the roof of the building, and went off 1/100 of a second later. The noise was awful. The passing pressure wave was worse. Both men watched, ignoring the danger. The echoes were punctuated by the tinkle of glass from 1/2 mile around. "You okay?" Ding asked. "Yeah, time to boogie, partner." "Fucking A, Mr. C."
They got down to the bedroom level as quickly as possible. Chavez cut most of the way through the cords with a pocket knife. He figured it would take them about 5 minutes to work themselves free. The alleys allowed them to drive from the area and keep out of the way of emergency vehicles, which screamed their way to the remains of the three buildings. Half an hour later, they were back in the safety of the Russian embassy. Vodka was offered. Vodka was drunk. Chavez had never experienced so bad a case of the shakes. Clark had. The vodka helped. To the people of the United Islamic Republic, the United States of America says this. First, we know the exact location of the germ warfare factory. We have asked for and received the help of the Russian Federation. They are neutrals in our dispute, but they have knowledge of this type of weapon. A team of technical experts is now on its way to Tehran. They will land, and you will take them immediately to the facility to supervise its neutralization. They will be accompanied by journalists for an independent verification of the facts. If this does not happen, then 12 hours from now we will destroy the site with a low-yield nuclear bomb to be delivered by a stealth aircraft. Do not make the mistake of thinking that I am unwilling to give that order. The United States of America will not tolerate the existence of that facility and its inhuman weapons. The 12-hour period starts now. Second, your prisoners will be treated in full accordance with international convention, and also the stern and admirable laws of hospitality, which are part of your Islamic faith. Your prisoners will be returned as soon as you deliver to the United States the living bodies of every single person who had a role in preparing and delivering those weapons to our country, and those behind the attack on my daughter. On that, there will be no compromise. Third, we will give your country a week to comply with this requirement. If you do not, then America will declare and wage unlimited war. You have seen what we can do, what we have done. I assure you that, if we have to, we can do more still. The choice is yours to make. Choose wisely. Finally, and I say this to all nations who may wish us ill, the United States of America will not tolerate attacks on our country, our possessions, or our citizens. From this day forward, whoever executes or orders such an attack, no matter who you are, no matter where you might hide, no matter how long it may take, we will come for you. I have sworn an oath before God to execute my duties as president. That I will do. To those who wish to be our friends, you will find no more faithful friend than we. To those who would be our enemies, remember that we can be faithful at that too. My fellow Americans, it has been a hard time for us, for some of our allies, and for our enemies as well. We have defeated aggression. We have punished the person most guilty for the cruel deaths in our land, and we will have a reckoning also with those who followed his orders. But for the rest, let us now recall the words of President Abraham Lincoln. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to do all which may achieve and cherish a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. Thank you, and good day. Epilogue. Press Room. And finally, I am submitting to the Senate the name of Dr. Pierre Alexander to fill the post of Surgeon General. Dr. Alexander, after a distinguished career in the United States Army Medical Corps, then joined the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine as an associate professor in the area of infectious disease. He was very helpful to me during the Ebola outbreak. Dr. Alexander is a brilliant clinician and researcher who will initiate and oversee several new programs, including basic research in rare infectious diseases, and will also head up a new federal oversight commission to coordinate AIDS research. This will not be bureaucratic, the president said. There's enough of that. The idea here is to set up a new system by which physicians and other research scientists can more easily exchange research data. It is my hope that the Senate will see quickly to confirmation of his appointment.
That concludes my opening statement. Jack pointed.
Yes, Helen?
Mr. President, your opening remarks on China...
I thought I made that clear. We have had private discussions with the Republic of China and concluded that the restoration of full diplomatic relations is in the best interests of both our countries. It is not the policy of the United States to discourage countries with freely elected governments. The Republic of China is such a country, and merits our full respect and recognition.
But what will mainland China think of this?
What they think is their affair. We are both sovereign nations. So is Taiwan, and it's time we stopped pretending otherwise.
Does this have anything to do with the shoot-down of the airliner?
That matter is still under investigation. Next, Ryan pointed.
Mr. President, the new Iranian provisional government is reportedly seeking to establish full diplomatic relations with our country. Will we entertain that request?
Yes, we certainly will, Jack replied. If there's a better way to turn an enemy into a friend than by open discussion and trade, I don't know what it is. They have been very cooperative, and we still have an embassy building there. But I suppose we'll have to change the lock on the front door.
There was general laughter.
Yes, Tom. Nice tan, by the way. Welcome home.
Mr. President, thank you.
Regarding the destruction of the germ warfare lab outside Tehran, the only journalists who ever got in there were those two Russians that their embassy drafted for the purpose. How can we be sure?
Tom, the Russian experts who supervised the neutralization of the facility were indeed experts. We have video of their procedures from the reporters, and both I and my consultants on this matter are fully satisfied.
Ed?
Mr. President, the prisoner exchange is now concluded. How will we respond to Iranian and Iraqi requests for credit?
Secretaries Adler and Winston will be flying to London next week to discuss this with representatives of both governments.
Sir, a follow-up. Will this mean preferential prices for imported oil, and if so, for how long?
Ed, those are subjects for negotiation, but I suppose they will offer us something in return for the credit approval they desire. The exact details will have to be worked out, and we have two very good men to handle that for us.
What about good women? A female reporter asked.
We have a lot of those around, Denise, including yourself. In case you haven't heard, Special Agent Andrea Price, POTUS gestured toward the door at his right, has accepted a proposal of marriage. It will be a mixed marriage, however, as her fiancé, Inspector Patrick O'Day, is a special agent in the FBI. I wish them the very best, even if it means I may need a new bodyguard.
Yes, Barry, he said, pointing to the senior CNN reporter.
So the big question that nobody has asked yet today, Mr. President,
Ryan held up his hand.
There is so many things yet to be done just to get the government fully functional again after all we've been through.
Sir, we're not going to let you off the hook.
A smile, a sigh, a nod. A surrender.
The answer to your question, Barry, is, yes, I will. Thank you, Mr. President.
Concluding quotation.
It is now the moment when, by common consent, we pause to become conscious of our national life and to rejoice in it, to recall what our country has done for each of us, and to ask ourselves what we can do for our country in return.
Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. This concludes the reading of Executive Orders by Tom Clancy.
Copyright 1996 by Jack Ryan Limited Partnership.
This book was read by Michael Pritchard.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.